One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
This is Ross Coulthart, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
I'd like to thank Wongo Puzzles for sponsoring this episode. My house is filled with all sorts of jigsaws, shape games and puzzles, definitely a favourite of the family. A very welcome addition to those has been Wongo Puzzles. If you're looking to try something new and exciting, then pick up a custom designed, unique, handcrafted puzzle from Wongo Puzzles. It's the perfect balance of good fun and a challenge. Even the folks in Congress who couldn't work VLC Media Player during live UFO hearings would be able to give it a go. They are 100% wooden puzzles. They will last forever. Each piece is hand-drawn, so no two pieces are the same, and you'll discover some fun, whimsy pieces as you work through it. They come in a custom wooden box, which is perfect for storage and gifting. Personally, I'm a big fan of the snow globe puzzle. Gives you that all-year-round festive feeling, and you'll see what I mean if you pick that one up. What are you waiting for? Go to wongopuzzles.com and pick up your puzzle today, and be sure to use the promo code THATUFO to get 10% off your order. This is the most fun you've had with a puzzle, guaranteed, or your money back. Go to wongopuzzles.com and use the code THATUFO to get 10% off your order and get puzzling right now. Hi everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined today by a guest based in the UK, which I always like to have on. He is an author who, after his own incredible encounter, decided to reach out to those with similar experiences and detailed over 130 first-hand witness accounts of close encounters with triangular UFOs in the UK, including stories of Missing Time and Men in Black. I'd like to welcome to the podcast Colin Saunders. Colin, welcome.
Thank you, Andy, and thank you for inviting me onto your podcast.
No, very good to have you on. And it's always nice to speak to a guest based in the UK because it means I'm not up recording at silly time o'clock. It's nice to have like a lunchtime recording and have the rest of my day. And as we record this little peek behind the curtain, the UFO hearings are due to take place in the US Congress in a couple of hours' time. So looking forward to getting into that. But just because of when this show is going to go out, we won't be talking about that because it's not happened yet, folks. So if anyone's expecting my opinion or Colin's opinion on those, they've not happened and won't be happening for another few hours. Colin, a little bit about yourself first. Can you tell the listeners about your own background and your early interest in the UFO subject, if you had any?
Yes, thank you, Andy. Basically, I had no interest in the UFO subject at all prior to the sighting. The interesting thing is my working career. I'll quickly touch on what I've done in the past. I've been a draftsman all of my life. My discipline has been electromechanical drafting. And notably, I've worked in the aircraft industry. I spent 12 months working in Germany, working on the Airbus, the early Airbuses, the A300, the A310. We built the fuselage in Hamburg, and I spent, like I say, 12 months working there. I also spent 2 years working for Saab Aerospace in Sweden, in a town called Linköping. I was based there 2 years, like I say, working. 1 year I worked in the cockpit, the second year I worked in for the engines and the wings and the horizontal vertical stabilizers. Again, electrical drafting. Fantastic job, fantastic experience. I've done quite a lot of traveling as well. I worked in New Zealand for 18 months. And more importantly, I worked for Chevron Petroleum for 12 months as well in Aberdeen. It's been quite an exciting working career, I have to say. I've been a contract draftsman. So all of the jobs I were doing were basically 12 months or 2 years long. You were paid by the hour. And it was a great way to make a living and met a lot of interesting people. The interesting thing about working in Aberdeen, I was based on shore, but I did have a couple of offshore flights. And when you go offshore, they drill it into you've got to get the work done correctly. Because once you come back on shore, back to the office, if you've missed anything, you can't get on the next helicopter to fly back out again. So you've got to make sure you get the work right. You check it and you check it again. And as soon as you get back, you draw it all up. Now, that was sort of invaluable training when it came to the night of the UFO, because applying the same sort of constraints that when I seen the craft, I was trying to take as much information in as possible. And as soon as I got home, I started doing drawings of it along with my daughter. So the whole of my working career, even today, I'm 65 soon, and I'm still drafting. I've been drafting all of my life. So I think that makes me quite a good witness as to what I saw and to the final model that I've produced of the craft that we saw that night. So that's a brief history of my working career, which would then lead us on to the UFO sighting.
It does. Colin, do me a favour. Are you able to tilt your camera down very slightly?
Yes.
Just for the... Yeah, that's brilliant. That'd be brilliant, yeah. Just so I can get kind of more of... A little bit up again, just to get more of you in the shot. Just try that. Yeah, perfect. That's the one. Good stuff. And I'll get Dan to cut that bit out for me when he edits the video. So yeah, I've made a note. Thanks, Colin. You mentioned the UFO sighting. So if you don't mind, let's take the listeners back to your and your family's day. It was a Wednesday, I believe, the 31st of March, 1999.
That's correct, Andy. Yes, it was my mother-in-law's birthday that day, actually. She was 72 years old. We decided to go out for a family meal. My brother-in-law, he bought the house next door to my mother-in-law, or next door to his mother, and he came along as well in his vehicle. So there were two vehicles on the night. My wife was driving, and we had a daughter with me, and we picked up the mother-in-law from her house. And my brother-in-law came along with the French contingency. He's got a French partner, and her grandparents had come over for the week. So two vehicles. We went to the White Line in Paleton. Pelton's in Warwickshire. It's a tiny village, middle of nowhere. The next nearest village is Monk's Kirby. And then we get on towards Hinckley, where we was living at the time, Hinckley in Leicestershire. But we'd been to the pub, we'd had a bar meal, and then we left. And I remember as we left, we got into my wife's car. My wife was driving. And as we pulled off, I looked round, and my brother-in-law was getting into the Range Rover. But the old lady was struggling a bit because, you know, it's quite a step to get into the Range Rover. So that we left without them, and I thought, well, they'd soon catch us up, they wouldn't be far behind us. And off we went through the country lanes. Now, we came up to an old Roman road called the Foss Way. This is the way back home, and it joins up to the Watling Street, the A5, at a place called High Cross. So for people some people have been to ley lines, they say that Roman roads were built on ley lines. So the Foss Way and the Watling Street are both Roman roads, and they intersect just a couple of miles away from where we was about to have the sighting. So we'd driven through the countryside and we came up to the Foss Way, and somebody actually said, oh, we're turning onto the Foss now. And my daughter jokingly said, oh, there's been talk of headless horsemen down here. We all laughed and joked and said we'd keep our eyes open for him. But as we turned the corner onto the Foss Way, there in front of us, half a mile away, were some lights flashing away by the side of the road. And we were just astounded straight away to say, look, what on earth is that? There's no lights up and down the Foss Way. There's no street lights. There's no pylons, there's nothing down there at all. And we're saying, well, it's too many lights for a helicopter and too low to be an aeroplane or anything like that. And they just seem to be hovering by the side of the road. So we drove towards these lights, talking excitedly. And then we came next to the lights. We parked next to the lights, which would, I would say, was 100 feet away. Now, I always say this, at 100 feet, I'm good with dimensions. My friend of mine has got a 70-foot canal boat on the Ashby Canal, and I've steered that many times. So when I say 100 feet away, I mean these lights were 100 feet away. You could have hit them with a cricket ball. Unbelievable. So we stopped the car, and we were staring at the lights. There was four big red lights at the back and one small light underneath, but there was no craft. There were just lights, and there was a white light mingled in with the red lights. And it was just astounding to see, but we had no idea what we were looking at. So the four big red lights at the back were actually tilted at an angle to the earth. They weren't flat, straight, parallel with the earth. They were tilted at about 30 degrees. So I was staring at one of these red lights, and it got like a crisscross effect on the surface. It looked like a traffic light lens, but it wasn't etched onto the surface. It looked like some sort of, I always say, Newton's law of ring interference. It was an effect of the light coming out from the back of the craft. We didn't realise it was a craft at that time. And I was staring at this crisscross effect, thinking, that's pretty amazing. Whatever that light's made up of, it's producing this weird effect. And when I thought that, I started to see the sky ripple around the lights. And I thought, my word, it's not just lights. There's something there. There's something around the lights. And the instant I thought that, the craft decloaked. It was like Star Trek. You know when the Klingon ship just decloaks and it's there in front of you?
Yeah.
That's what happened around the lights. This metallic craft suddenly materialised in front of our eyes. Now, the craft was that low, and the rear end was facing us. It was that low that the rear end stayed where it was, and the nose floated up in the air. But it floated up like a submarine underwater. The movement was incredible. It was so low that if it had tilted from the middle of the craft, I believe the bottom of the craft would have struck the ground. So the rear of the craft stayed where it was, and the nose floated up in the air in front of us, like a horse rearing up in front. Although, because we'd been looking at the rear end, what we were looking at now was the top surface of the craft, which is unusual in itself. Not many people get to see the top of a craft. Most people see the bottom as it's flying overhead. Mm. But for us, the way it floated up in front of us, it gave us a complete view of the top surface. And it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And as an engineer, I just couldn't believe what I was looking at. It looked like it was organic. It looked like it was alive, even though it's been clearly manufactured. The surface of the craft had got liquid running up and down it. It looked like a lake at night with the moon shining on it with a slight ripple on it and the beams catching the waves as they ripple. It looked like that going up and down the surface. But on top of this liquid were these silver beams that were interlocking. They were like girders on the surface, interlocking like an old-fashioned maze pattern. It was just absolutely incredible to see. And my wife, who was very sensible, put the hazard flashing lights on, and there was a gateway underneath this craft, and she decided to pull forward and reverse into the gateway. Now, the problem was, as she pulled forward, it blocked the view of the craft, and I thought to myself, if it's going to go, it's going to go now. And sure enough, we reversed into the gateway, we jumped out, and the craft had gone. We got out of the car, and there were no sign of it. There were no smell of any aviation fuel. It was deathly quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And there in the distance was the largest craft I've ever seen going away with four big red lights at the back. Again, the same as the small craft we're seeing. I said, look, there it is. But it's changed. It's grown into this massive thing. And the girls were going, oh, I don't know, that's a long way off. It's probably half a mile away, this big craft, or maybe even further. But it looked huge and it was just going away. So that was the end of it. Like I said, there were no smell of any aviation fuel. Nobody else was involved. And then cars started to come up and down the road again because there'd been no traffic whatsoever during the course of it. We got into the car and it was 9:50 p.m. We checked the time and drove back home. Now, the strange thing was when we got back home, my brother-in-law, who lives next door to my brother-in-law, he'd got back already in the Range Rover. Not only that, all the French occupants inside were inside the house having a cup of tea. So they'd obviously arrived home a while before us, but we never saw them pass and they never saw us as they were trying to catch up with us, which seemed very, very strange. So that were the sort of nuts and bolts of the sighting. Now, there is more to it, which we'll come back to, because there was a little bit of paranormal high strangeness that happened as well. For the first 20 years of this experience, and generally I only spoke about the nuts and bolts of what took place, which is what I've just done now. But like I say, there is a bit more to it that's paranormal. And we'll come around to that because times have changed. People are more accepting of this now. I never used to speak about it in the past because I thought people would think I was crazy. Yeah. But we'll come back to that. So what we did,
Colin,
then...
Do you mind if I ask you a quick question, just so I've got right? Because the story... No, that's okay. The story's fascinating. I'm just trying to. I always like painting a picture in my head of the event, and I think I've made it out roughly. And so, in the car, there's yourself, your wife, and your daughter, yeah,
and the mother-in-law,
and so your mother-in-law were all in the car, yeah.
Wife was driving. The mother-in-law was in the passenger seat next to her. I was behind the mother-in-law on the near side, and my daughter was next to me on the off side.
And from a point of view, you mentioned the distance being 100 feet. So we've got listeners all around the world. That's 30 metres. And I even had to look up, just for my own frame of reference, 30 metres is two buses or 1.5 10-pin bowling lanes. So that'll help people kind of create the distance. That is not very far at all. So you are very, very close to this object. And that obviously helps you get a really good view of the detail you're discussing as well. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, it was that. Honestly, it was that close. I could have hit it with a cricket ball. It was just unbelievable. Especially when it materialised, you know, and rose up in front of us I mean, when they say how big was it in front of you, it completely filled the field of vision. There was nothing else you could see but the whole of the triangle in front of you, right up in close.
Do you think the object, the craft, was aware of you? The fact that it materialised at all, rather than stay cloaked, stay invisible, stay out of sight?
Yes. I've had a long time to think about this, and I do believe that the craft was waiting for us, and I do believe it wanted us to see it. I mean, it was completely lit up like a Christmas tree. And also, I've got a feeling, because it was at this angle, I want to say it was like an angle of about 30 degrees to the Earth, so it would have had the bottom, although the craft wasn't materialised at the initial sighting, but it would have had the bottom tilted up towards us. So as we're driving towards it, without realising, we were looking at the bottom of the craft as well as the four big red lights at the rear of the craft. Because of the angle, we could see all of the four red lights and the other lights and the white, but we couldn't make out what it was. It was just all mixed up together. Now, I think if the craft had been parallel to the Earth, then we would not have seen quite so much of the lights underneath. So I believe it intentionally tilted itself up so that it gave us even more to look at as we was approaching it. Now, the strange thing is that when we come to draw pictures of it, me and my daughter drew the same, and my mother-in-law didn't draw it, but she described the same craft. She said it's got girders on the surface interlocking. Now, my wife, who was the sensible one of the party, wasn't actually, she didn't actually see the craft materialise. She saw the lights as we approached, but once we stopped on the lights, she was being sensible and looking up and down the road for traffic and decided to put the hazard flashes on and reverse off the road, so she didn't see the craft materialise. So I did ask her to draw what she'd seen, and she drew three red lights in a perfect triangle, a perfect equilateral triangle, and there was no way we could have seen that from the aspect ratio, from where we was looking at that craft. No way could we have seen just three red lights underneath. And I thought that was really odd. So a couple of months later, I asked her to draw it again. And again, she drew exactly the same thing, three red lights in a perfect equilateral triangle. So I came up with a theory, because this happened for a reason, and I was trying to figure it all out for the last 24 years now. But I came up with this theory that the small craft was like a bait, if you like, for an ambush. And it was there all lit up like a Christmas tree. So we absolutely were focused on that craft as we drove up to the lights. However, my wife may well have seen the large craft that we've seen afterwards when we got out of the car. That would have been passing possibly over the car at the same time as we was looking at the little craft. Now, in the book, there is a picture, I believe, of the little craft on the ground and the big craft coming over the top of the car. Now, I don't know if that took place. I can only guess, but it would make sense that she's seen the underneath of the larger craft as it came over the car and drew three red lights in a perfect equilateral triangle, whereas the other three of us were transfixed on the little one in the field right next to us. So part of me believes it could have been sort of an ambush, in effect, that night.
I'd like to thank BlendJet for sponsoring this episode at a time when many of us are certain more than ever top-secret technology is being hidden from us by our own governments. One private contractor is leaving the hangar door wide open. The BlendJet 2 is the pinnacle of portable blending technology. BlendJet 2 is portable, so you can blend up a smoothie at work, a protein shake at the gym, or even a margarita on the beach. It's small enough to fit in a cup holder, but powerful enough to blast through ingredients like ice and frozen fruit with ease. BlendJet 2 is whisper quiet, so you can make your morning smoothie without waking up the whole house. That's a real benefit for me. Lasts for 15 or more blends and recharges quickly via USB-C. Best of all, BlendJet 2 cleans itself. Just blend water with a drop of soap and you're good to go. You can choose from over 30 colours, including royal blue, glacier and slate, all very stylish. Many of you have already been in touch telling me you picked up a BlendJet 2 and love it, so thank you for supporting the podcast and getting yourself a cool bit of tech. If you haven't yet, what are you waiting for? Go to blendjet.com and grab yours today, and be sure to use the promo code THATUFO12 to get 12% off your order and free 2-day shipping. No other portable blender on the market comes close to the quality, power and innovation of the BlendJet 2. They guarantee you'll love it or your money back. Blend anytime, anywhere with the BlendJet 2 portable blender. Go to blendjet.com and use the code THATUFO12 to get 12% off your order and free 2-day shipping. Shop today and get the best deal ever.
That sounds strange.
No, I mean, all of this is strange, isn't it? That's just the whole subject in general. It's hard to see reason and logic in so much of it. And other people report from various sightings, two or three or four or five people can all be looking at the same object but describe different things. So there is always the chance as well that just because of who she is, her, you know, people talk about the frequencies people give off, vibrations, or just what they were meant to see, people see different things and people react differently to it as well. And I wonder, when those craft go, you've mentioned you're then back home and you check the time, what's the immediate conversation like in the car amongst you and the family?
We were just, from memory, we were just talking about how amazing it had been and what we'd seen. I can't remember too much about the journey on the way home, but I do remember when we got to the mother-in-law's and I realised that everybody was in the house already from the other vehicle, rather than get out of the car and go in and talk to them, I just sat in the back of our car feeling really chilled out and not really wanting to get out and talk to anybody at that point. Now, that might be because there was something more to go into that took place on that night, and we'll come back to that. And you say this is a strange subject. It's going to get a bit stranger shortly. Nothing too outrageous. We didn't see any aliens, but something did take place. And, yeah, it is funny how different people perceive things differently when they have a close encounter. That's got something to do with people's psyche and the spiritual side of this.
So what did happen next? What's the knock-on effect of this experience?
Right, so as soon as I got back, I mean, the next day I expected everybody to know about it. I thought it'd be in the newspapers. I thought everybody would have heard about it. I didn't think we were special, you know, but it wasn't the case. And the next day, funnily enough, is obviously April Fool's Day, the 1st of April, and I'm trying to tell people, because I've just started my own business at home. I was working from home at the time. And I got three members of staff working for me as well. It was getting a bit cozy at home. We're just getting to the point where we needed to move out. But it was good that I was at home and I had the experience because I couldn't concentrate on work for a while. And I decided to make models. But I was telling people the next day what had gone on. And people were believing me. But it wasn't in the newspapers. It wasn't on the news. It wasn't on the television, which I found surprising because I thought everybody would have seen it that night. So I started doing research on the internet, obviously, and looking for UFOs. The first person I phoned was a friend of mine who years ago had said he'd seen a UFO. Nobody really believed him, but I phoned him up and said, "Hey, Reese, you never guess what I saw last night?" And he goes, "A UFO." He goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Was it triangular?" I said, "How do you know that?" Because I was gobsmacked that it was a triangle. You know, if I was going to make this up, I would have said it was a flying saucer. I didn't know anything about UFOs. I wasn't in any UFO circles. And if you'd asked me what a UFO was, I would have said it was a flying saucer. Well, it turned out that Reese's own encounter was with a UFO, a triangular UFO. And that was over the Caterpillar Works, quite near to where we are now, at Desford. He said it was huge, this triangle, and it was just sat above the factory. And the little red light had come out from the front of the triangle, was going round and round the front of the nose. And then eventually it went back into the nose. So he then gave me the phone number of the UFO magazine. And I phoned them and I spoke to a guy called Graham Birdsall. He used to run the UFO magazine years ago and put some fantastic conferences on in Leeds. He gave me the number of Omar Fowler. We became good friends. Omar was, the late Omar Fowler, was very much into triangular UFOs. And he came around and interviewed myself and my mother-in-law, my daughter and my wife. But more importantly, he gave me a document to read, a magazine. And in there, he'd got a Belgium sighting from the 90s, where in Stockis, a young lad had seen a triangle UFO come over his head, and he drew a picture of the underneath. And it got the same lines in relief coming off the surface interlocking, the same as that we saw on the top of our craft. So I thought that must be the same craft or the same series of craft, because we never saw the bottom of the triangle. So I decided to use the Belgium sighting and put it with my sighting of the rear and the top to make the complete craft. So we've got the same sort of symmetrical girders, top and bottom. So what I did then, I drew and I made some paper models, which I used to take to Omar's UFO group and do a presentation and talk about the sighting we had. But then I made a wooden model. I got some doweling and some plywood and stuck some pictures on that I printed off from CorelDRAW of the triangle and made a nice little proper 3D model. The funny thing was that that was stolen from my van on the driveway. Somebody broke into the van I'd got for, I was using it for work. And when I took the van to be repaired to my friend, he'd said it had been professionally broken into, the way they'd taken the lock out and they'd stolen this old cassette player that was worth nothing. Even in them days, it wasn't valuable. And he couldn't understand why somebody would do that. Now, it wasn't until a week or so later when I was looking for the model that I realised whoever took the cassette player also took that model. I never did see it again. It had gone. Whether it was just coincidence or whether they were looking for the model, I don't know. But that led me on to build the next model, the Mark II version. This time, I decided to buy some flashing LED lights and a battery pack to try and make it a bit more authentic. And after 20 years, I've still got that model here. And this is it. And I've got, and it's still flashing away and it's still working. You can see the beams on the surface here. You can see this is the Belgium sighting of the underneath with the beams that are turning through 90 degrees and interlocking. So that's a copy from the Belgium sighting. We never saw the underneath of this triangle. We only saw the top with the liquid surface and the beams and the rear. But no point did any of us see this big switch on the side here. That's just for putting the lights on and off.
So I'll tell the people, imagine.
It always gets a bit of a laugh.
Can I just ask, let me ask Colin, because I'm interested, and this might be a straight up no. The lights on the back, was there any pattern to the flashing?
Yes, it was a crisscross effect. Like I was trying to explain earlier, it was, if you get a laser pen and shine it and look at the light coming out, you'll see it starts to make little indentation, little waves. And that's what it looked like coming out the back of the craft. This is a larger version. We'll get onto this one in a bit. But on this version, I don't know if you can quite catch it there. You can see there's like back a crisscross effect on the lights.
Sure, okay.
And then that was the effect that we were getting on the night. We'll get to this craft in a moment because this is my pride and joy, this one, that a friend made for me. So the first model I made, I managed to get onto TV with that, and Central Weekend Live, it was called, here in the UK, and speak to 3 million people live. I did one or two presentations. And then it sort of all went quiet. I mean, I was doing research on the internet. There's been times over the years where I've tried to forget about the UFO subject, but it just wouldn't go away. It just keeps coming back. Now, the model that I built was really great, and it used to make me shake when I took it out of the briefcase and switched it on with excitement, thinking back on the night. But it hadn't got the lines raised off the surface in 3D, and I always wanted to try and achieve that. And then a friend of mine, John Mills, he came to see me one day out of the blue and said he'd brought a 3D printer and he wanted to produce a model of my UFO for me with the lines on the surface. So that was brilliant. So we started working on that together. A guy in Canada had done some fantastic computer graphics of my model. You'll see those in the book. Well, graphics of the craft itself. And I showed these to John so he could use those to make the model. So the first model he made was this one. Now, this is like an A5 size craft, but you can see it's got the beams raised up on the surface. You can just about make that out, I think, on the camera there. There you go. You can see the beams there, and the same with the bottom of the craft. And he put some lights into this, and it was brilliant. And I couldn't believe that he'd managed to do that for me. And I was really pleased with that craft. But the only thing was it wasn't the right colours. So what we decided to do then, I said to John, because it took him quite a bit of time to manufacture this craft, to get all the files together to print it. I said to him, if we start selling some for you on the internet, on eBay, for instance, if I sell enough, will you make me a larger model in full colour? And he agreed. So I started advertising these triangles and he started manufacturing a few. On the website that he'd been to, there was a flying saucer and there was also a cylinder. a tubular, what do you call them, a cigar-shaped UFO.
Cigar-shaped, yeah.
So we decided to manufacture those as well. So we ended up selling three UFOs on eBay, a triangle, a flying saucer, and a cigar-shaped UFO. And eventually I sold enough. All the profit went to John, and once he got enough money together, he made me this large model, which I just briefly showed you a moment ago. Now, it did cost quite a lot to manufacture this, not just in terms of the material, but the paint on the surface cost quite a lot of money. So if we're looking at the surface of this craft, you can see that it looks like it's liquid on the surface. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you can catch that. And then you can see the beams on top of these interlocking. And at the rear end, we've got the four red lights, which have even got a bit of a pattern on them, very similar to what we saw that night. And then underneath, we've got the Belgium sighting of three red lights in the corners and one in the centre. So
For the listeners who are on the audio versions of the podcast and can't see it, there'll be some links that you can check out the book and see the actual picture. But it reminds me a little bit of the Star Destroyer from Star Wars. If you cut the front half of it and forget the back, it's just that kind of that width, and it's got a chunkiness to it. And like you say, that kind of detail on the top as well. I'd like to thank Cure Hydration for sponsoring this episode. In our fast-paced, frantic daily lives, we can often forget to look after ourselves as well as we should. Simple things like staying hydrated can be forgotten. I know this as well as anyone. Even mild dehydration can cause headaches, muscle weakness, and brain fog. Sound familiar? Yeah. But there is a solution. Cure. Whether you're in a call centre and sat at a desk all day or off to meet your friends at the gym for a workout, staying properly hydrated is key to performing and feeling your best. Cure is the ideal solution to on-the-go hydration. The packets are convenient and easy to use. Just mix with water and drink. They're perfect for on-the-go travel or anything you need a quick and effective hydration boost for. It's made with completely natural ingredients, is vegan and gluten-free and non-GMO, making it a great option for anyone with dietary restrictions or preferences. I love the fact it's 0 grams of sugar and only 25 calories per sachet as well. So, ready to combat dehydration? Try Cure today and feel the difference for yourself. Use code THATUFO for 20% off your order.
Yeah, it's a fantastic craft that John has built for me. And one important thing that which you audio people won't see, but the centre of the craft has got a white core running all the way around it. And the top of the craft and the bottom of the craft join onto this centre white core. And the skin of the top and the bottom rolls over like a skin on a hovercraft or like the pastry around the edge of a pie. That's an important detail that I'll come back to very shortly. I think that's about it as far as the nuts and bolts are concerned of this sighting. So unless you've got any questions about that, I'll just the one, Colin.
Yeah, just the one. Did you get the feeling, because I've had my own triangular sighting I've discussed on the podcast before, did you get the feeling that it was something non-human, or did you get the feeling this is human technology, potentially back engineered or top secret technology?
No, straight away I knew it wasn't from this world. You could just tell. The way it manoeuvred, the way it came together, the way it actually looked, everything about it was just so, so strange. And you could tell immediately when it started to manoeuvre in front of us. There were three thoughts came into my mind immediately. As the craft nose rose up in the air, the first thought was, my God, aliens exist. The second one was abductions must take place. And the third one was that this explains mysteries that we've had in history. Those three thoughts came to me straight away when the craft came up in front of us. I've been to a few air shows and I've worked on aircraft. I've never seen anything like this. And just everything about it was so surreal that there's no way, not for one moment did I think it was man-made, to be honest, but it was clearly manufactured.
And I'm not sure if you're going to get to this, but when you've mentioned that you checked the time, you knew it was 9:50 p.m. I think it was, and you also noticed that people had gotten home before you. Was there missing time of your own from this experience?
We don't know. We haven't got a reference point from the time we left the pub, unfortunately, so we're thinking no, there was no missing time. No.
Okay, that's fair enough. I wasn't sure. But yeah, if you want to carry on, you're going to mention the paranormal side of this.
Yes, it's becoming more and more apparent now, isn't it, in the mainstream that people are talking about the paranormal effects of close encounters with UFOs. So if we go back to that night, the 31st of March 1999 at 9:50 p.m., as the craft floated up in front of us, and I got the three thoughts that, my God, aliens exist, etc., all of a sudden, it was like somebody had got a pair of binoculars and put them in front of my eyes. It was like I could see the craft close up. I could see the surface right in front of me. And I could see a couple of the bits of the interlocking beams. But then the next view, and it was like one view after another, was of the nose, of the big round nose. And I was right in front of it looking at it, and I can remember thinking how beautiful it looked. It was like ever so spherical, the way it had been manufactured. It was just, I can't describe the beauty of the engineering. And then I saw the side view. Now, to build the model with the white central core, I wouldn't have been able to do that without this extra view, because I got a close-up of the side near the nose at the top. So I could see the white central core, and the top and the bottom were rolled over onto this side, went central core, but there were no nuts and bolts, there were no welding, no seams. I mean, it looked absolutely fantastic. For those who are looking on YouTube, you can see where it was. I was looking at a close view of the nose up here, and where the top and the bottom join this white core, like I say, there was no nuts and bolts, no welding, no seams. It looked absolutely fantastic. And the next thing I remember is saying, I want to get out. Like, me and the mother-in-law, we wanted to get on board. We're dead excited. And that's when my wife drove forward and we lost view of it, and that was the end of it. So the next day, I'm talking to my wife and my daughter and my mother-in-law, and I'm saying, you know, I've had this close viewing, and the only thing I could think was I'd had an out-of-body experience, that I got so excited at seeing the craft materialise in front of us that somehow I got out of body and got close to the craft. But I didn't really know, but I started researching out-of-body experiences well after that event. But what happened next was, the very next day, we start to get like electrical problems at home with the TV, a video recorder, a clock in the kitchen and a kettle and a hard drive and one of the computers all on the same day, which was really quite strange. But then I started personally to have other experiences. I started to see other lights in the sky and see them turning through 90 degrees. Some of them were quite close, but not to see any detail. And then I was starting to have other strange paranormal experiences. And what I decided to do was make a note of them and the date and the time every time something happened and keep a list of it. And I've done that, and I've put the list in the book. Some of them might be natural occurrences, but I don't think so. But one of them, for instance, I'll tell you this one because this was an important one. This one was the only time I've ever been frightened in the whole of this experience. I was fishing down on the River Soar at Rothley in Leicestershire. And I love fishing, and I'm standing in the river. There's a bit of a steep bank going down to the water. So I'm standing in the water with my waders fishing away, and I'm actually in a fishing competition, but it's a small club, and I'm in a field on my own. And I hear footsteps coming across the field towards me, four footsteps. Now, I know in the past, because we're on farmland, there's been people shooting down there. So I decided to climb up the riverbank, make myself known, because I didn't want them shooting in my direction. Now, when I got up to the top of the riverbank, the noise continued, but I couldn't see anything. There was nothing, but the noise was getting louder and it was coming towards me. And eventually it walked in front of me, probably 6 foot in front of me from left to right. And I thought it was a big cat. I was really quite frightened. So what I did, I got a spike out of my rod holder that I used for my umbrella. And I decided if it was a cat, I'd go back down the bank, get it to jump on me and impale it on its own weight. That was my game plan. And I stood there petrified. And this thing walked from left to right, but there was nothing there, and there were no grass moving, no twigs moving, and it just sort of faded away as it went past. And I stood there and I thought, that wasn't here. That was somewhere else. That wasn't a big cat. Cats don't make noise. We've got big cats in the countryside here in the UK, but they don't. I'm sure they don't make noise like that when they're walking along. It was four heavy footsteps, whatever it was, and then it faded away, and then I realised it was some sort of weird space-time contingency, some sort of dimensional thing. And that was the day, Andy, that I actually decided, because I was having all these things from the UFO, and this is 18 months on from the contact of the UFO, that I'd had nothing prior to the UFO, but all these things afterwards, that meant that the UFO for me was dimensional. It was not extraterrestrial at all, because somehow it's come through and it's left some sort of a, done something to me, some sort of an imprint that's allowing these other things to come through. Because I'm a technical guy, I've been a technical guy all my life, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And it would make sense to me that this has got to be dimensional. I had nothing prior to the UFO, but quite a lot of experiences after the UFO, nothing at all before. So it's got to be linked, it's got to be connected. Now, years ago, in the early days, I got to see a guy called Bud Hopkins, the late Bud Hopkins. He came over to Leeds to a conference that Graham Birdsall had organised with Russell Callahan. I met some fantastic people there. I met Dr. Roger Lear, Stanton Freeman, Stephen Greer, and I met Bud Hopkins, and I managed to get 30 seconds with Bud. There was a queue of people wanting to talk to him. I told him about the triangle, how it materialised in front of us, and then how it felt like somebody put binoculars in front of my eyes, and I thought I'd had an out-of-body experience. And Bud said to me, no, he says, you've not had an out-of-body experience. Those are images placed in your mind by the aliens on board the craft. And I thought, that's a bit weird. And just as he said that, this woman burst in with a crystal she'd found in the forest, and she wanted to talk to Bob about it, and she muscled in and pushed me out of the way. And that was the end of my 30 seconds with Bob, unfortunately. He didn't get a chance to expand on that. Now, I found that a bit odd, so I put it in the list of things that were going on and kept a note of it, put it on the back burner. But I was still clinging to the out-of-body experience, because I thought it gave me a bit of comfort, because I was starting to think that you could live without your soul. You know, your life force continues. Although I'm not a religious person, I was starting to wonder whether there was some sort of life after death, because I felt like I'd been out of my body to look at the craft. So I kept that up for quite some time, and we never know the answers to any of this, really. We're only guessing at what's going on. But I gave a presentation with one of the small triangles that John had made me, the first 3D printed ones, to a Birmingham UFO group run by Dave Holdren. And I talked about the close viewing, and Dave said to me, I've got a case similar to that. And it was about a couple of guys who'd seen a UFO land in a field that was like miles away. But they stood at a gate watching, and they seen the occupants come out of the craft. And then they said one of the guys' faces all of a sudden was right in front of them, like it had telepathically come across the field and was telling them they shouldn't be there and they've got to go. And I thought, well, that's, you know, a bit similar to what had happened to me with my close viewing, but not exactly the same. But then, as coincidences go, within a couple of weeks, I got an email out of the blue from a guy in America. Now, I've put his email in the book as well, because it's important to me. He started off by saying he'd had a close encounter with a triangle, and he said, and just like you, I've had three images placed in the mind. So during the close encounter, he went on to say that these three images, there were snapshots of a close-up. One was the pipes running on the outside of the craft. One was of a light source in between the V at the back. And I think the third one he thought was possibly inside the craft itself. So I read this email and I thought, and I'd been listening to a lot of David Jacobs' work, Dr. David Jacobs, on all the abductees that he'd been interviewing over the years. And telepathy was coming up more and more in the conversations. And I'd always thought in my naivety that telepathy was words between two people, but inside your mind. So you'd have a conversation like we're speaking now, but in your mind. But it's not always the case. As David Jacob points out, a lot of abductees are given images and pictures and shown things. And when you think about it, a picture paints 1,000 words, doesn't it? So it was like a eureka moment. All of a sudden I thought, yes, Bud Hopkins was right all along. Those images were placed in my mind by the aliens on board the ship. Now that took some getting on board, I tell you. With that, I thought, how weird's that? I mean, I can't go down my local pub and tell people about telepathy with an alien. I think I'm absolutely crazy. I mean, that's a good thing about these podcasts. At least you're talking to the converted, preaching to the converted, if you like. So that also fell into place then, the fact that the other three occupants of the car that night were not having these other paranormal experiences. It was only happening to me. Okay. And that would make sense, because on the night it was only me who had the close viewing from the craft. There is another reason I can't quite bring it to mind now why I say it. I think it was, oh yes, because I had wondered that if it was an out-of-body experience, why it was like three instantaneous views. There was a close-up of the craft, the beams on the surface, then there was a nose, and then there was a side view. Now, you would think if it was out-of-body, you'd see the nose, and then you'd see the craft roll. You'd see it turn to show me the side view. But it wasn't. It was like three instant images. So it made more sense then that those images would have been placed in the mind rather than me getting out of my own body and getting next to the craft. So that seemed to make more sense then. So that's what I ended up deciding, that I'd probably had telepathy from either the craft, because some people believe the craft is alive, and it did look more organic, I have to say. Maybe it's some sort of highly advanced artificial intelligence, I don't know. But either the craft or the occupants on board gave me those images, and the only reason I think they did that was to be able to make the model. To make the exact model, this last model I've got, the coloured one, is as close as you're going to get to the real thing. So, but why would they do that? To write the book like I've done now. Now, the book's going quite well. There's a lot of interest in the book because there's a lot of interest in UFOs. So for anybody who's to ask, you know, why did this occur, then I would say it's to write the book and to build the model and to be part of some sort of subtle disclosure.
Now, that's something that many people have talked about in the connection when they have one of these experiences. It opens a bit of a doorway. And many of those experiences you have talked about, I've heard from all kinds of guests, including George Knapp, Thomas Winterton, people involved in Skinwalker Ranch and others. And it makes me wonder, do you think that happened then for this to come out now? And this is something I've asked before to people who made the documentary about the aerial phenomenon, that these events may have happened 20, 30, 40 years ago, but they almost lay dormant in terms of any activity happening or consequence off the back of it. And you've brought the book out at a time where we've got hearings on the horizon, there's more eyes on the subject than there's ever been before. And that, like you say, it helps towards raising the awareness of the subject. And I'm guessing you've had a lot of people since the book was released in December reach out to almost reaffirm that this has resonated with them, that they can, you know, associate, they can empathize, they sympathize with these experiences because they've also had them too. Yeah.
That's right. Yes. That's a good point. And like you say, this thing, although it happened 20 years ago, initially I wouldn't talk about the paranormal side of things because it wasn't really accepted. It's now becoming far more acceptable, to the point where I was watching a recent UFO program on Blaze just this week, and they were talking there about people having close encounters going on to have other paranormal experiences. And they've even got a name for it. They call it the hitchhiker effect.
Yeah.
Now, I'd never heard that until this week, and I'm thinking, I can't believe that. I've just brought a book out talking about the hitchhiker effect, and now they're talking about it on the TV as well. It's becoming far more commonplace, and they were talking about, they believe now that they're dimensional rather than extraterrestrial. So what happened when I started writing the book, I'd done my own history about my working career, and I talked about the experience with the UFO and the model building, but there wasn't enough there to fill a book. So I decided to start putting in other people's sightings. Now, a lot of people have been in touch over the years with their own encounters. So I had to dig those up from old emails and messages on Facebook and get all the information together, but also reach out to people, because I've got a lot of friends now on Facebook. A lot of people have had UFO encounters. And I was asking specifically for UFO, triangular UFOs in the United Kingdom, obviously, because that's what my main interest lies in, triangular UFOs. Now, as the UFO reports were coming in, I was asking people if they'd had any other paranormal experiences, either with UFOs or ghosts or anything before or after or anything. And the response was amazing, because people are more open now than what they used to be. You know, a couple of hundred years ago, you get burnt at the stake for saying these things. Hmm. But there were so many people coming back saying yes, there were more than saying no. So in the end, I decided to put a whole chapter onto UFO encounters where people have had other experiences during the course of their life as well. And it doesn't surprise me the things that people are talking about. That just seems to go hand in hand now, that if you have a UFO experience, you know, a close encounter, you're quite likely to have some other paranormal experiences as well.
Now, let me ask, as we march on and we'll get to some listener questions soon, there's, like you say, a lot of stories and other testimonies within the book. Some of those mention Men in Black and missing time. Is there any particular one you'd like to share that stands out to you?
Yeah, there's a couple, actually, that I find absolutely fascinating. We'll start with Charles B, if you don't mind. I'll just read what he has to say.
Please, yeah.
This was an encounter December 2011. Okay. Basically, they'd seen a light in the sky and there was out chasing it, him and his daughter in the car. And then he says, we both realised it maybe was a helicopter, but there were no strobes and no noise. Somewhere between Cleasby and Manfield, we lost sight of it as it got too low. We looked for the object but decided to give up and turn back home. As we drove back home along the A67, I said, let's look down by the river at Low Conniscliff. With hindsight, I think they told me it was there. After driving down the track to the river, it was probably about 300 feet above ground level. It was huge, at least 1,000 feet across. The lights at the apices were dim yellow-orange and there was a dimmer orange light in the body towards the back. I got out of the car and stood staring at the triangle. There was total silence. I could no longer hear the traffic from the nearby A1M motorway. The body was black and it blocked out the stars, but I could see stars around it and also a nearby farmhouse on a hill south of the river. It also seemed to block out the breeze. I don't know whether I got closer to it or it to me, but it seemed right underneath me. I seemed to be right underneath it. I could see black channels etched in the underside of it, which would have made me think they were a docking mechanism. It seemed to be made of a slate or graphite material, very dark grey and a smooth matte texture. I could feel the presence in my whole body and a dental implant was vibrating in my mouth. I could see the channels covered the underside of the craft. They were probably 6 feet across and of a similar depth. I raised my hand and touched part of the craft's body between the channels. I was terrified and even thought it could harm me, but I did it anyway. I brushed my fingers over it and then put my entire palm on it. It felt like a hard kitchen worktop with a matte finish, but it was not cold. The next thing I remember is my daughter shouting me to come back to the car. She hadn't wanted me to get out. And that was the end of that particular encounter. So the guy there is talking about a craft that is 1,000 feet across, descending so low that he could actually stretch up and touch the underneath of it. I mean, you've got to marvel at the engineering of these guys, whoever they are flying these craft. It's absolutely fantastic to be able to do that without, you know, any harm to the person who's underneath the craft. There is another report in the back of a book of a guy who's actually, he got that close to one that he said he put his hand into the liquid surface of the craft. He said it was like putting your hand into a tin of paint. I've got another sighting here I'd like to quickly read to, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
I find this one interesting as well. This is a lady called Lindsay Turner, 1983 in Nottingham here in the UK. Said, my friend was 3 years older than me and we were unemployed at the time. We decided to go and visit Dad's property, a 10 to 15 minutes walk away, and we arrived at 8 till 9 p.m. The house had a football pitch just beyond the back garden with wild space surrounding it. The weather had been dry all day. When we came to leave late that night, we glanced over to the football pitch for an entrance. We both spotted the mist and the triangular pyramid-shaped craft, so we decided to go and investigate. The pyramid object was the size of a council house and not quite on the ground, but hovering just above the ground by about a foot or two. The pyramid looked to be made of glass and was transparent. I could see swirls of coloured gas inside, yellow, blue, green, in fact like a rainbow. As they approached the pyramid, it backed away from them, but when they backed away, the pyramid returned to its original position. The craft then became solid. In fact, Lindsay described it as metallic with Egyptian hieroglyphs on all sides. One of these hieroglyphs was a man with a bird's head carrying a long spear. They then got nervous and decided to go home. They think they lost 3/4 of an hour on that particular sighting. I found that incredible that the side of the craft was covered with Egyptian hieroglyphs. So there's a link there between ancient Egypt and triangular and pyramid-shaped UFOs that are appearing today. Lindsay had also had other experiences when she was a child with ghosts, so that comes under that section of UFO and the paranormal.
Are you familiar, Colin, with David Marler and his work on triangular UFOs?
Yes, yes, we're friends on Facebook, and I've read his book, and he's got a copy of my book as well. So, yes, I'm quite familiar with his work, yeah.
Lovely. He's a very nice guy, and he's considered one of the foremost experts in the world on triangular UFOs. Do you believe people, what they're seeing in Belgium, in the UK, in the US, Canada, Brazil, Mexico, they're all witnessing the same phenomenon, that these craft are in a way linked, you know, whether that's from the same entities, the same species, or the same program? What are your thoughts on what we're seeing worldwide?
I would always thought that the triangles, wherever they occur, are going to be known to each other and going to be piloted by the same race. I don't know. We just don't know, do we? We don't know if different races have different craft, whether the saucers have different humanoids to the cigar shape to the triangles. But I would imagine that all the triangles are known to each other. It's a technology that's been made somewhere, and they're all sort of sharing that technology. So I'm sure they must all come from the same sort of base or dimension. Now, I say that because I've got a theory, if you'd like to hear it, about some manufacturing of this craft. A friend of mine sent me a video from a guy on YouTube, Boz somebody, who was doing a lecture in a university on quantum levitation. He took a piece of metal and put it into liquid nitrogen and froze it down to 0 degrees Kelvin, and it became a superconductor. And then he put it in a magnetic field, and it just sat in this magnetic field without moving a little millimeter or anything. But the thing I noticed about it, it was covered in vapor because it was so cold. So I looked at that, and I came up with a theory, because on the night when the craft materialized in front of us, when it decloaked, I noticed that the wingtip towards where I was looking at the fourth red light, I could just make out the wingtip. A fluffy white cloud appeared around the wingtip. Now, I realised from building the model that when you tilt the nose down, because initially I thought there was a diamond shape in the sky when the craft materialised, but I instinctively built the triangle with a flat bottom. But if you tilt the nose down slightly on the triangle, you will get the silhouette of a diamond. And the little red light underneath the bottom of the craft, you can see it there for people on YouTube, you can see the silhouette of a diamond. The little red light at the front of the craft comes into view. Now, my initial drawings, there were four red lights at the back and a small red light off to one side. Now, the small red light off to one side was also covered in mist, like a smoky effect. So I came up with this theory, because I'd seen the mist on this quantum levitation video, that the liquid that's on the surface of the craft that we saw may well be something like liquid nitrogen. And the beams that we've seen on the top could well go through the skin and be immersed into the liquid underneath. That would then turn all of the beams on the surface into superconductors, top and bottom. And that would then give the craft quantum levitation, which would allow it to move around in the magnetic field without any other propulsion system. Now, the reason why I think that might be true is because there's a lot of other craft that people see, and they report seeing like refrigerator pipes running up and down the surface. I've even got a picture in the book from Michael Schrapp, another friend of mine on Facebook, who's been kind enough to allow me to use his image of a triangle with all these pipes running along underneath. And I'm surmising that those pipes are the same sort of thing as the liquid here, that those pipes are carrying a liquid like nitrogen, something really cold. All those pipes are becoming superconductors, and the craft again has got quantum levitation. So I believe a lot of the crafts that you see with the pipes on, they're all using a similar technology to each other to be able to create the lift that's needed and the pitch and the roll. But that's only a theory. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, because the guy who touched the bottom of the triangle and the other guy who put his hand into the liquid, if it was liquid nitrogen, it would have froze his hand off. So I don't know if that theory stands up. It was just an idea that I had. I mean, it sort of makes sense.
No, I understand. I'll put the link in the description. Just while you were talking, I checked. It's Dr. Boaz Almog. Has done the experiment on the superconductor. So I'll put the link for the YouTube to that. So people can check that one out as well. And just talking about the idea that maybe some of these triangles are potentially of human origin or back-engineered technology, how much have you looked into the story of the mythical TR-3B triangular craft?
The TR-3B, I think, originally was created by a guy called Edgar Fouch. It was done as some sort of misinformation. I believe, personally, having worked in the aircraft industry, for instance, when you work at Saab, you do you build a certain amount of craft. You build from 0 to 75, and you don't make any major implementations or changes on those craft. These craft are going to go all over the world and need to be serviced, and need to have maintenance teams. Then if you want to make changes, you'll make it from craft 75 to 150, and you do it in that sort of orderly fashion. You don't change every single craft that comes out. Otherwise, you're going to lose track of what needs to be maintained and what spare parts you need. So in the book, I've got 130 different sightings. Now, no two sightings are exactly the same. As far as I'm concerned, that's 130 different triangular-shaped craft of different sizes, different colours, different features about the craft. And I'm only scratching the surface here in the UK. There must be thousands of sightings, and worldwide there's got to be hundreds of thousands of sightings of triangles. So to think that these are all coming from like Area 51, manufactured by the Americans, is just crazy. The logic just doesn't hold sense, because you will need maintenance teams to be able to service these craft. You will need all the spare parts. And if every craft is different, you can end up with a logistical nightmare. If you look at the F-117 and the B-2 bomber, they're all exactly the same. They didn't make any major changes. All the craft, and they didn't make a lot of them. They only made like 100 of each, something along those lines. Yet the triangles are coming all shapes and sizes, and they're all over the world, thousands of them. So there's no way that all of these are being made as TR-3Bs. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I have no doubt that the military are trying to create something. And if I've got these ideas about what I think the craft is made from and how it operates, I'm sure the military have got far cleverer minds than mine working on the project. Whether they'd be able to do it, I don't know.
Have you read
the materials that are used are not available on this planet? We don't know.
Potentially. Have you read the Secret Machines books, the Tom DeLonge collaborations?
I haven't, no.
I'm on the audiobook at the minute, and it's been painstakingly long. I've been listening to it over a kind of period of time. But the part of the book I'm at just now, and I'd be interested in any listeners' thoughts, is where it jumps around the history of the last kind of 75 years of the UFO topic, but in, you know, kind of, it's a story, but with assumed knowledge as part of it. And basically they're at the point where there's a pilot who has been selected to he thinks he's going into a simulator, but it turns out it's a real triangular craft that they've back engineered, and he is essentially flying it with his mind, and almost joyriding it. You know, go here, go here, go here, and they get into trouble for flying all over the place. And it just made me think there when you mentioned that everyone's seeing different craft, you know, the idea that the military would be jumping in one craft and it's just one pilot thinking, I'm going to pop to Paris, I'm going to pop to Belgium, you know, I'm going to pop to South Africa, and they're all seeing the same thing. Like you say, there must be a number of these craft coming from different sources, whether it's one origin point, but there must be so many different types of craft out there that people are seeing.
There's some odd shaped ones as well, isn't it? It's not just limited to cigars and saucers and triangles. You get all sorts of strange craft, even like square blocks and rectangles and all weird manners of craft. Yeah, it's interesting you should say that they fly the craft by using the mind. You hear that a lot from abductees, really. That's the only place you can get information from. People who have been abducted who come back, there's been a few of them talk about flying the craft using the mind. And another thing, like if these craft were secret American TR-3B projects, why would you fly them over a populated area in the UK or Belgium? Why would you fly them at rooftop height? You know, you just wouldn't do it. The chances of a crash and the consequent fallout from that would be tremendous. You just wouldn't. You wouldn't entertain it. So, yeah.
No, that's always, I think, the most logical argument against it, isn't it? That why would you test it on or around other humans? Because it just takes one to go wrong and you've got a disaster on your hands.
You have, yeah. One of them could possibly wipe out the whole of London if it crashed, if it had got some sort of a atomic device on board. Who knows? But yeah, there's no way that I believe these are TR-3Bs. I'm not saying we're not trying to work on them. And if we have got one, we've probably only got one, maybe a couple. I don't think we've got thousands that are seen all over the world. I mean, in the book, the earliest sighting I have is 1956. And that's a guy who saw a triangle in the book. But doing research of late, I realised there was one in 1561 in Nuremberg, when there was a battle in the sky there between different UFOs. It's all been recorded in history. And towards the end of the battle, a large black triangle came upon the scene. And that was 462 years ago. So I don't think that was a TR-3B.
No, and I think, again, that's another very reasonable argument against a lot of this technology. Is when you talk modern times, it's very easy to talk about drones or secret government technology, but you just have to go back a few decades or more to think in the 50s and 60s, they didn't have this sort of craft flying around. It just seems so unlikely when you go back that far that they had access to that technology. And the TR-3B question came from Dalimar over on Patreon, so thanks for that. I just want to ask you a question from Peter over on Patreon as well, Colin. Have any UK sightings been reported after any sort of CE5-type summoning events?
There are one or two in the book, yeah. There's a guy, Darren Cooper, I don't know if you've heard of him in the UK.
Heard the name, yeah.
Yeah, he had a close encounter after using Stephen Greer's app for a CE5 encounter. And there's a second one in there as well. Chris Boner, I think his name was. They had a CE5 meeting as well. They managed to call the craft down. Yeah, so there are a couple of instances in the book there where it's occurred. Majority of the time, it's just happened out of the blue. But to answer his question, yes, there are a couple of instances of that, yes.
Thanks for that. And MJ Jumps had also asked about the TR-3B, which we've discussed there. So thank you from the YouTube channel. And a final listener question from Lindsay over on YouTube. Does Colin know of any sightings of triangles formed of multiple lights along each edge, not underneath, that they pulse on and off, red, then off, white, then off, if that makes sense?
Yes, I have put quite a few drawings and sketches that people have made into the book. And some of those do have a lot of lights going around the outside of the craft, not just in the centre. That's an interesting point because going through the book, I've made some notes on some of these similarities. And as far as lights are concerned, all manner of lights have been talked about, you know, not just red and white, but there's green and blue, yellow, orange, bronze, purple and pink. And yeah, a lot of those have. There's lights all over the craft. They're not just restricted to three in the corners and one in the centre. Well, that does seem to be the common sort of layout that you see. But yes, there are definitely far more layouts of lights than just that. Also, the colours of triangles varies as well. I've always thought they were just grey and black. But in the book, we've got talks of orange triangles and silver, gold, white, blue, dark brown, and even a green triangle as well. So they come in all shapes, sizes and colours by the looks of it.
I hope no one can hear any noise in the background from my microphone. It's either some kind of abduction experience or the local council are jet washing the pavements outside where I'm recording. So I'm going to go with the latter. So apologies if anyone does pick that up. I don't think you should have, unless you've got some incredibly good earphones. I just want to finish off, Colin, by asking you, when people pick up a copy of the book, so it's Triangular UFOs of the United Kingdom, and it's available on Amazon and it got released in December, what do you want them to take away from it?
I think with the book, it's a bit of a niche market, really. People who have had an experience with a triangle will find it comforting. I'm getting that already. People are contacting me to say that they know they're not alone and they're not crazy. They're not the only one who's seen a triangle and they're not the only one who's possibly had other paranormal experiences, because it can be quite shocking for some people to go through this. I know it was for myself, although it's always been a positive experience. It was very, very stressful in the early days, thinking about what was going on. I remember that, how it sort of changed my life and my perspective. And I just wish that when I had my experience, there was a book available like this that I could have read, because that would have made me feel a lot better and made me understand about what I'd seen myself. So for anybody out there who's had an experience, I would suggest that you buy the book and have a read and find that you're not alone. There are a lot of people who've had experiences, and a lot of people have a lot more weird experiences than what you have yourself. So you've got nothing to worry about. And I'm sure you'll find it a thoroughly enjoyable read as well.
And how can folks get in touch with you, Colin, if they want to, on social media?
I think I'm on the Facebook, so if you message me on Facebook and if you've got a story, I can give you my email address and we can have a chat and hopefully sort some more new information out about these triangles. But I do find it fascinating how it's moving forward at the moment.
I'll just say I did enjoy the book, and it's not just a collection of, oh, someone saw a triangular UFO in the sky at various heights, there you go. It's the nuances, the details of the craft around it, like you say, those paranormal experiences and those kind of all-encompassing events that kind of make up a body of evidence again throughout the book. So it's really good work and well-researched, so well done.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation with you, Andy, and hopefully we'll sell a few of these books and people will get a bit more knowledge about a triangular UFO.
That is all for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. You can like, retweet and subscribe. That would all be very much appreciated. The shows are being uploaded onto YouTube as we speak more and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/thatufopodcast to access the shows ad-free as well. Please get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, That UFO Podcast. Of course, on Twitter, it's @UFOUAPAM. And again, folks, as always, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer. More like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. Expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little.
I'd like to thank Motley Fool for sponsoring this episode. I've said before on ads that looking after yourself financially gets harder and harder with the cost of everything going up. Being a tight Scotsman, I use every method I can possible to save a little here or make the most of what I have there. Motley Fool is one way that you can definitely look to maximise your income from investments. The age of stock picking is here, with towering inflation and elevating interest rates. Sticking your money in a passive market just isn't going to get you what it used to, but it doesn't mean you have to abandon the market. There are still ways to invest for the future. You just need to know where to look, which is where the Motley Fool comes in. The Motley Fool Stock Advisor Service highlights two stocks each and every month for members to add to their portfolios, and it literally is paid to listen to them. Historically, their average stock recommendation is up over 400% as of April 10th, 2023. And listeners of That UFO Podcast can now access Motley Fool Stock Advisor for just $89 for their first year, a full $110 off the list price. What are you waiting for? Visit fool.com/podcast. That's fool.com/podcast to start your investing journey today. $110 discount off of $199 per year list price. Membership will renew annually at the then current list price.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.